Welcome back, readers and romance seekers, to Hopelessly Romantic Behind the Page. I hope you are all doing very well, and I'm ready to sneak back into the negotiator with all of you. Last week, I didn't really talk a lot about the author, Melinda DiLorenzo, but really there wasn't a lot on her to find. Sometimes it kind of seems to be a little bit of a hit or miss whether or not I'm going to find information on the author with the Harlequin writers. Sometimes they have a website, sometimes they don't. If they don't, usually I can find a small profile and a bibliography on fantasticfiction.com. I've mentioned the site a couple of times, and I really haven't looked into it all that much. But the more I've been doing this podcast and reading these books, I've had a little bit of an opportunity now to kind of see what it is. More or less, it seems to be a book and author catalog, and it's kind of bare bones beyond that. And it's not really centered on a certain genre either. It's not just romance. It looks like all types are welcome. They say, I think, there's about 80,000 authors that they have listed on their website. I'm really not sure who fantasticfiction.com is for. It's not really a review website, or at least I didn't see anywhere where I could add a review. And as far as I can tell, you can't buy the books there. According to the front page, you can follow authors and maintain a to-read list. And if I'm being really honest, kudos to whoever's running the site, because it doesn't look terribly, I don't know, I'm not sure what to call it. I'm surprised that it's running, I guess is what I say. It looks like it maybe fell out of the early 2000s, but it's still running and apparently, I guess, has a healthy traffic input, I suppose, considering that it's still up and going and they have really recent updates. So I'm really curious as to how that website works. And yeah, again, who is it for? I'm not sure. For my purposes, though, it serves to help me research the authors. Usually what happens when I read a new book by a new author is I want to understand the context it was written. I'll do this a lot when it comes to reading something brand new, or even something that I've read before as well, and I want to know more about the author and who wrote it. Book dragons and literature nerds like myself are surely aware of the concept of death of the author. It's a little pretentious, but then again, it is a French invention. In the simplest of terms, death of the author is just the act of consuming media, like books or films, without considering the author's context or the world in which the work was birthed. But for me, that's not really possible. I'll even get myself into trouble sometimes. I'll find something out about a book if I'm trying to research on it, or I want to know more about the author, and then I find out the author is, let's say, an interesting individual. And it's really hard for me to separate the author from the work. So, for instance, DiLorenzo is Canadian, so therefore it makes sense that her book takes place in Canada. I didn't mention it, but The Negotiator is in Canada. And a challenge for many writers, myself included, is to remove our own personal biases from the work, but they still manage to slip in every now and again. I don't think an effective examination of the text can be completed without an understanding of the author's life and the influences surrounding them. And in my very personal, very unfounded opinion, we cannot kill the author without killing the reader, so to speak. How the writer creates her text can be influenced by her surrounding environment and her external and internal influences, while how I, the reader, will perceive the novel will also be based on those exact same elements. My own biases, my cultural filter, if you were, will inform my reading of the text. I mean, it's really kind of what the basis of literary analysis is, right? The author sat down, they had something to say. it doesn't matter what they were trying to say. They wanted to say it. And whether or not they did this subconsciously or if they knew they had a set theme or concept they want to impart on us, it happened. And when I pick up a book, I maybe had something in mind that I wanted to read. And it's basically a form of communication, I guess you could say, between the reader and the author. So if you want to kill the author, you got to kind of kill the reader too. And I don't think it's really possible to have a pure reading of a text removing any cultural or personal influences. I don't think that it is possible. Now, does this mean that the protagonist of a novel should be considered the mouthpiece of the author? Of course not. I caught that particular lesson in a review session for a writing class, when my peers had pretty much concluded that my work had the smell of basically what was opposite of my views on a topic. I think it's a really good example of what we say and how we say it is really important, even when it comes to fiction. Like the most fiction of fiction, we have to keep this in mind. As this relates to The Negotiator, I talked briefly about the dead woman trope making itself known via Jake's sister, Scarlett. So you might remember that Scarlett was a drug addict. She did manage to get herself clean, as well as get herself into a healthy relationship, baby and everything. By all accounts, her story is very compelling, made all the more tragic considering that she never got to enjoy her new life. And her death was technically a result of the poor choices that she was making while sick with addiction. And I do mean sick. More and more research is coming out that classifies addiction as a disease, but society is still treating it as a moral failing. What does it say when Scarlett is introduced as an addict and basically dead from the beginning of the story? I really do think that this is up for the reader to decide, but for me, personally, I can't help but look at it from the perspective of what I've extrapolated from the dead woman trope. Like I mentioned, the dead woman trope comes in two flavors. Perfectly innocent woman dead from circumstances beyond her control, or women who are less than savory characters and whose deaths are softened by their lack of moral cleanliness. I think a good example of the two types in action can actually be found in Cold Case Colorado from episodes 3 and 4. Ah, wait, don't lose me yet. Stay here. I know the book was a hot mess and I can't believe I'm about to use it as an example for something, but it does illustrate the dead woman trope in both its flavors rather effectively. It'll hit you over the head with a hammer of subtlety, but it does the job. Brittany was an absolute bitch, only out for the money that she had no entitlement to. She was mean to her cousin, you know, our protagonist of the book, and riding on the coattails of the family name. She was murdered, ugh, but it's okay because, you know, she was terrible. We're not that sad about it. Then we have Aunt Dorothy, who is basically a saint in comparison. Even with her argument with her brother, which caused the rift of Vanessa's family drama, she loved her niece to the point of wanting to bestow everything on her, and she tried to steer the people in her life down safe and gentle paths. Unfortunately, that's what made Keith murder her, but everyone, besides him, loved her, and that is why her murder is the greatest tragedy of all. I know I said for The Negotiator, Scarlett seemed to fall into the category of, well, she wasn't a great person, being a druggie and all, so it's okay that she's dead. But on reflection, she falls in sort of the middle of the two types. It's sad she died because she was trying to be better, but if she hadn't gotten to drugs in the first place, well, she wouldn't have gotten murdered. See what I mean? The dead woman trope is rather interesting in how it's deployed. And that's why I consider the death of the author question so important, how different authors use certain tropes and the directions that they take them in, the concepts are not used in a vacuum. I think there's also elements of the women in refrigerator trope. That is a purely not my trope, if you haven't heard of it. This is actually a concept that goes back to comic books. I'd have to look it up. But, you know, basically the women in refrigerators trope basically refers to, let's say you got a superhero, like I said, comic books, and he's got a wife or a girlfriend, and she exists only to die so he, the hero, can become motivated to fight against the bad guys. The trope gets its name from basically a comic where someone's significant other was basically murdered and shoved into a fridge, and that was her only purpose in the story. It is rather gruesome, but a lot of times the women, the dead women trope can kind of fall underneath the women in refrigerators because it motivates our characters. You could argue that Aunt Dorothy's murder was a motivation for Vanessa to figure out what she was going to discover. As far as the negotiator goes, Scarlet was kind of, I guess, just killed in order for, what's his name? Jake. Yeah. Jake to receive custody of Desmond as his son. Like, her death is the only reason that Desmond is his, and therefore kidnapped by Miles and Lockley to get what they want. I could probably go way forever with this trope, but I think that's probably going to be another day in another book that it probably might suit better. although in the romance genre, I don't think we're going to fall into too many women in refrigerators trope. I think Jake's sister's death is the closest we've come to because, you know, Scarlet was murdered by the guy who ended up trying to kidnap the kid again. So there you go. Also, I'm really not a scholar on the concept of death of the author, so you want to take everything I say with a huge grain of salt. I've just got, like, you know, a basic bachelor's degree, and I haven't really done a lot more research on the subject beyond what my degree called for. So anyway, did the romance work with the suspense? I might say the jury's out. I think it worked better in this book than it did in Cold Case Colorado. Even though the genres are slightly different, this is suspense, mystery is a little bit different from suspense. They overlap a lot, but it's not a one-to-one ratio. It's a little, it felt strange. The romance in The Negotiator felt strange and a little rushed, pretty much, but it was handled better than it was in Cold Case Colorado. I know I spent a lot of time hammering that point home is like, there are other things that are more important than trying to smooch each other in this situation. It's just, the circumstances are weird. it's strange for me. I really, really want this concept to work. As weird as it is, I want the mystery / suspense romance to work, because I think it's interesting. The concept is intriguing, but so far it's almost there. It's almost there. I know that there can be a way for this to work. I've got another book. We'll hear it later, a few episodes down the line. But I have high hopes for that one. And I think if I have one more final note, really, I was just frustrated with Lockley's character. I thought in the story, like before the ending, she was really interesting. I kind of wished that they had added more clues, perhaps, to Lockley's double agent status, I guess you could say. But I feel like she was like, I don't know. It's just, I'm just disappointed. I'm just kind of disappointed with how her character turned out. I'm not unfamiliar with a character who looks evil but is actually quite good. I think that could have made her a lot more compelling as a character, a triple agent maybe. She can't reveal herself until the absolute very end, make it look like she's the villain, drop even more clues pointing to her villainy, And then she reveals herself to not be a villain from the very beginning. And you can see her be backed up by her superior officer. And I think that would be interesting. I don't know how deep undercover cops can get. In the book, it's actually described that Lockley was in the car with Miles when he ran Scarlett and her then boyfriend off the road. And I think it was kind of insinuated that Lockley was meant to be undercover. Like, they understood that Lockley was undercover in that moment when she was in the car with Miles, which is pretty dark if you think about it. But we could stretch reality for a really good story. So I don't know. It's just disappointing. The ending was a little bit disappointed because of that reveal. I think with that, we're going to go ahead and move on to what I have been reading this week. And I am actually kind of excited about this one. I am reading Axiom's End by Lindsay Ellis. You've heard me mention Lindsay Ellis maybe once or twice before on the podcast. She is a video essayist on YouTube. And I've been a fan of her work for a few years now. She's really, really very compelling. I love the way she presents her concepts and her media. And I really like her takes, I guess you could call them, on popular media and movies. The Whole Plate series, based on cinema theory and cinematography via the lens of Michael Bay's Transformers, is just wonderful. She's very, very cool. And last year she released a book called Axiom's End. It is a first contact science fiction novel. There's a lot going in there, but it really, really works. And I loved reading this. It also probably helps that I've mentioned that I read via audiobooks. The audiobook narrators are fantastic. I think her name is Stephanie Willis, and then there's Abigail Thorne. Their performances really, really sell the story. They're so engaged in the story that they're telling us. And Stephanie Willis, she is just so into the book. I can hear Cora's voice, basically, and she has such distinct voices for all the other characters. It's great. I really cannot recommend the audiobook enough. If you haven't done audiobooks before, that would be one I would recommend to try out first. Basically, the story starts with Cora. She's a college dropout. She was getting a linguistics degree, and her father, her estranged father, is actually a sort of, what's his name? WikiLeaks. Julian Assange, I think? Yeah, a Julian Assange type of person who basically, you know, drops information about the U.S. government and insinuating that there's other life out there. And she ends up being pretty much in the middle of a conflict between, like, these alien creatures. They're called amygdalins because they have almond-shaped eyes. I guess amygdalin means almond. And it's hard to explain in some ways. Basically, she meets an alien called Ambersand, and he's on the run from a genetic purge from his home planet. It's kind of dark, but it's so compelling. And she basically has to help him survive, him and the others like him, survive on planet Earth. There's conspiracy theories, maybe a little bit of hint of the monster boyfriend trope, a lot of linguistic focus, because a good portion of the book is kind of about trying to develop a translation between the alien language called Pequod Phonemic and, I guess, the English language. I don't even know if I'm explaining the book very well at all. It's a great book. I loved it. Maybe my interpretation was colored by the fact that I really enjoy Lindsay Ellis's work in general. Who knows? It's, you know, that whole death of the author thing again, eh? This is actually a reread and reread twice over because I just want to read more of it. But I'm rereading it again because on October 12th, the next book in the series, Truth of the Divine, will be coming out. I'm definitely going to get the hardcover for sure. And I really hope that I can snatch a copy of the audiobook to borrow when it releases from my library app. Last year, I had to wait weeks for a copy to become available when it first came out. It was agonizing to wait. But I'm so excited. I can't wait. So I definitely highly certainly recommend going to read Axiom's End. It's also talks a little bit about the question about what makes a person, I suppose. Like many alien dramas do, it kind of talks and focuses on humanity, what it is to be human, the nature of our species. And it gets some really interesting conversations in there. And I think it's a really very, very cool book. I can't say enough good things about it. Just go read it. Go read it. Listen to the audiobook if you can. It's great. Go read it. And with that, I think I'm going to leave it here for today. I hope to see you next week when we read The Surgeon and the Princess by Karen Bain. Thank you again so much for joining me today, and I will see you then again on Hopelessly Romantic. If you like the show, you can visit us at hopelesslyromanticpodcast.com. And if you want to say hi or have any questions about the show, you can email us at contact@hopelesslyromanticpodcast.com. The show is written and produced by me, Heather Songster, and our technical advisor is Kwang Yun Cho. And remember, it doesn't matter what you read, only that it's what you love.